Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani and IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have another great show for you today. My guest will be Dr. David Walinga. He's a physician with more than 20 years' experience in writing, policy, and advocacy work in the intersection of food, nutrition, and sustainability, and public health. Currently working for the Natural Resource Defense Council and former co-founder of the Healthy Food Action. So he'll be coming on in just a little bit, but first I want to share with you some things in the news, some ways that you can take action, some events coming up, and of course my weekly recipe. So first, just a couple things that are coming up. If you are not already in Denver, you might be missing Slow Food Nations this weekend, which is a big event. It is bringing people together from all around the country and even some guests internationally to talk about food, food policy, good food practices, indigenous food cultures, how to be inclusive. This day and age, you know, there's so much talk about being inclusive, racial equality, equity, food sovereignty, so many issues that are crossing not just in food, but in healthcare and in so many different arenas. And it's a topic that is really fascinating and needs to be really addressed. So if you are in Denver, that's great. Definitely go down to Slow Food Nations. If you're not and you're interested in getting there, it will be a great weekend. On Monday, NOFA New York, which is our Long Island chapter of the Northeast Organic Farming Association, we will be hosting a potluck out at the Garden of Eve Farm in Riverhead. And that starts at 5:30 with a farm tour and 6 p.m. for the potluck. And you can RSVP to me at Bhavani at IE Green, and we'd love to see you there. NOFA is a wonderful organization really working to support organic farmers and to support the work nationally in protecting our organic integrity. And so if you care about organic food, NOFA New York is an organization you probably want to become involved with. So check that out at nofanewyork.org. Cornell Cooperative Extension is a local extension of farmers and master gardeners that are very helpful, and they also have a location out in East Meadow, at an East Meadow farm, and they are giving a series of garden-to-table cooking classes. And on July 9th, they're having a class on savory sauces, and then again on August 19th, they're having a class on freezer berry jam. So if you're interested in cooking and meeting other people that care about their food, Cornell Cooperative Extension offers great cooking classes. So does Elijah Farm, by the way, and Elijah Farm is also looking for an intern. So if you have not secured a working situation or you're looking to do some more work on a farm this summer, Elijah Farm is looking to hire. Also coming up on August 9th through 11th, NOFA, which is the Northeast Organic Farming Association, all of the chapters, so not just New York's chapter, but Massachusetts, Connecticut, Rhode Island, Vermont, Maine, all of them are coming together to have a big summer conference at Hampshire College in Amherst, Mass. The theme is Nutrition Matters, Soil Health Builds Human Health. And there will be so many different workshops going on with that. You can look that up online at the NOFA Summer Conference. And I hope to see some of you there. And the last thing that NOFA is doing this summer is NOFA New York is having their gala on August 23rd. Save the date. It's up in Poughkeepsie at Locust Grove Mansion, I guess it's a small mansion. But anyway, it's up at Locust Grove in Poughkeepsie. Should be a great organization. And NOFA is supporting organic food and farmers, human health, and the well-being of the planet. So please come to the Climate of Change Gala on August 23rd. And now some things that I wanted to encourage you all to take some action on. The USDA right now does not test for safety when it comes to genetically modified organisms. They really rely on the chemical companies that produce the GE organisms to do their own testing. And I'm really calling for people to ask the USDA to do their own testing. Of course, in this climate with the current administration, that's unlikely. But right now they're proposing new rules that will exempt almost all GE crops from any regulation, and it's really quite scary. So on my website, I have a link to tell the USDA not to allow companies to improve their own GE crops. Another thing that I have on my website that I really like to encourage you all to is a push towards, and I know this doesn't really have to do with food and health, but it is just so important, is the situation going on at the southern border. Whether we abolish ICE altogether is a question, but what we do want to do is stop these raids that are going on and stop separating families from their children. It's just horrendous. And so there's a lot of ways that you can take action and help. You can donate directly to the families. I have a bunch of different links up there on my website. You can support the lawyers that are fighting to protect them and get their kids back. You can donate to many different places at once. And again, I have a whole link up on my website. And you can also call and email your elected officials and just say that this is unacceptable. The way ICE is terrorizing neighborhoods and communities, it's just not okay. And lastly, you can call the National Families Together hotline and offer to volunteer. If you speak Spanish, they're really looking for help in that way. So those are things that you can do. No matter what, we all have a part here in making our world a better place. And so I just want to encourage you all, whether it's the ICE raids, whether it's the issue at the border, whether it's GE crops, whether it's antibiotic resistance, whatever issue you are passionate about, please become active. We need to rise everybody up to become active. And I know so many of us do good work in our daily work. We have to add something. We have to do something beyond and push ourselves to really help make a difference here, because we will never be able to stand up against the amount of money that these corporations and organizations have that are taking our country down. And what we do have is people power, but we have to get all the people up and active. So another thing I want to share with you that I have in the news in my newsletter is Stone Barns, which is a wonderful educational agricultural center up in Westchester. They are helping farmers to transition to regenerative farming. So they're looking for farmers that are mid-sized farmers, medium-scale farmers who would like to transition to sustainable agriculture, regenerative agriculture. They have a fellowship program going on. And I know in the farm bill there is not much support for farmers to transition. And most farmers who are conventional farmers got into farming that way because it was a push from our government. And they are not the bad guys, but they are stuck. And so this is a wonderful opportunity to help these mid-scale farmers who are conventional farmers who know that regenerative agriculture is a much better way to farm, not only because they'll be raising healthier food, but they'll also be helping to mitigate climate change by helping to sequester carbon from the atmosphere into the ground. It's just a wonderful opportunity. So if you are a mid-scale farmer looking to transition, please check out this opportunity at Stone Barns. And another thing that I want to share with you is the pesticides that are affecting our bees and our pollinators. And it was just announced this week that the Trump administration is putting back on a pesticide that is really bad. We've been hearing about so many of these pesticides that are just horrible, and they just approved putting back on sulfoxaflor, which is one that I hadn't even heard of, back onto the market, and it's just bad. So please sign the petition to get that out. And then lastly, I was writing about antibiotic resistance. It's been in the paper so much lately. Common ailments like a urinary tract infection, which used to be so simple to cure, you just go to the doctor and get some antibiotics, is now becoming a big problem because it's resistant to antibiotics. And my guest today, we will be talking a lot about antibiotic resistant bacteria and why it's here and what we can do, which is not that much. It's a real global issue, and it's really scary if antibiotics stop working. So stay tuned for that. That's going to be coming up in just a little bit with our guest, Dr. David Willinga. But I want to share with you my recipe before I invite Dr. Willinga on. This week's recipe I have shared once before, but this is a different variety. This is a cashew vegan cheese. These are a goat cheese similar Chev varieties, garlic dill, herb encrusted, and a spicy sun-dried tomato. And it's very simple to make this, although making the Rejuvelac, which is a fermented probiotic culture, which is needed to make the cheese, is a little time-consuming in that it just takes time for it to ferment. It's not difficult at all. So you want to start that like a week ahead of time to get the Rejuvelac going. And so you're going to take 1 cup of organic brown rice, or you can use millet or quinoa or another whole grain, and 6 cups of filtered water or spring water. Put the grains in a large glass jar and add the water, and just cover it with a sprouting lid or a cheesecloth. Secure it with a rubber band and let that soak for 12 hours. Then you're going to drain that and give it a rinse. And then you're going to cover that cloth and place it upside down at an angle in a warm spot, allowing the so that the grains can continue to drain out any water that did not come out. You want that to be able to drain out. And you're just going to leave it there. You're going to rinse the grains twice a day with water for about 3 days until you start seeing a little tail coming off of the brown rice. That's how you'll know it will be ready. You want the grain to start sprouting. And that will depending on the heat in your house. Like if you have the air conditioning going, it's going to take a little bit longer. But you want to put it in a dark, dry place and let that culture. Then you're going to cultivate the Rejuvelac by dividing the sprouts equally into 2 glass jars. Cover those grains with 3 cups of filtered water each, and place another clean piece of cheesecloth on top of that glass jar, also secured with a rubber band. And let that sit for 3 days in a warm spot until the water starts turning cloudy and white and has a tart, lemony flavor. And when that starts happening, you know that it's ready. You're going to pour the liquid through a strainer at that point into a clean glass jar. And actually, you can just pour it right through the cheesecloth. And that liquid is the Rejuvelac. And that can be saved in the refrigerator for up to 4 weeks or in the freezer. And what I like to do, I bought these really large ice cubes that are 1/4 cup each, and you need 1/4 cup for this recipe. So I freeze the Rejuvelac in 1/4 cup ice cubes, and that way I can just take an ice cube out each time I want to make a batch of the cheese, and I have the right amount. And so that's it for the Rejuvelac. And then to make the cheese, you're going to use 2 cups of raw cashews that you're going to soak in water for 5 to 8 hours. And the longer they soak, the less Rejuvelac you'll need to use in the recipe. You're going to mix that with a pinch of salt and the 1/4 cup of Rejuvelac. And so I always soak it for at least 8 hours, and I use that 1 cup, 1/4 cup, which is the 1 ice cube of the Rejuvelac, and that really works perfectly for me. And very often I double this recipe when I'm making it because it is such a process, and this cheese does freeze well, so you can make a double batch and freeze half of it if you want. But I'm just giving you a single batch recipe right now. So you're going to process the 2 cups of cashews with a pinch of salt and the 1/4 cup of Rejuvelac in your Vitamix or high-powered blender on high until smooth. And you have to scrape down the sides, and I have the part of the Vitamix that I can push down the cashews. And blend that up until it's really completely smooth. And then you're going to transfer that to a clean glass bowl and cover it and let that rest at room temperature for 8 to 36 hours. And I usually am doing it for 36 hours. The longer the cashew cheese sits, the sharper the flavor will be. And that makes it taste more like goat cheese if you let it sit for the longer amount of time. And then I take that and I make three different varieties. All of it I add nutritional yeast to. So I add a tablespoon of nutritional yeast to the whole mixture and a half a teaspoon of salt to the whole mixture. And then I divide it up into three different parts. And one part I make it herb encrusted. And so I take different herbs, parsley, thyme, sage, dill. Actually, I didn't use dill because I used dill in one of the other varieties. What else did I use? Rosemary. And I chop those up really fine. And I take a piece of cheesecloth, a piece of cheesecloth that's like 8 inches long or so. I cover the cheesecloth with all of the chopped herbs. And I place a log-shaped mixture of the cashews into the center and create a log and roll the cheesecloth around the cheese and roll the cheese. So I make a smooth, even log that's completely covered with the herbs. And then I tie the cheesecloth around the log. Each end, I tie it with some twine. And that will be one flavor. The other flavor is a spicy sun-dried tomato variety. And for that, I mix up about 6 sun-dried tomatoes that I mix with a teaspoon of chopped garlic. And if you want to add a little bit more salt, you can, but you don't need to. And blend that up in a mini food processor. Mix that in with the cheese. And then I took a teaspoon of a spicy chopped chili pepper sauce that I have in my pantry. You can use a harissa sauce, a sriracha sauce, or crushed red pepper flakes sauce, just to make the sun-dried tomatoes spicy. If you don't like spicy, of course, you can leave that out. And I mix that with the other third of the cashew cheese. And I lined a little bowl with cheesecloth again and put the third of that variety of cashew cheese into the bowl. And what the cheesecloth does is it really just makes it easy for you then to dislodge the cheese once it's set and put it onto a cheese board. And then that's one variety. So I cover that with the cheesecloth up and wrap it in saran wrap. And then the last one is a garlic dill variety, which I mix up 2 tablespoons of chopped dill and another teaspoon of garlic. Mix that in with it. And again, I line a bowl with cheesecloth. And you can pick your shape, whatever shape you want the cheese to be. If you want to make it into another log, you can do that too. And that's the last variety. And you can experiment with this. You can make whatever varieties you like. But it's really remarkable. It's so good. Everybody loves it. And it's really better than anything you can buy on the market. So check out this recipe. If you have any questions, of course, you can email me at bhavani@iegreen.com. And now it's my pleasure to introduce to all of you my guest today. And my guest is Dr. David Wallinga. And he is a Minnesota physician who has spent the bulk of his career as the self-described doctor to the nation's broken food system. And long before local food movement took off, Dr. Wallinga was writing about the myriad ways in which the typical American diet is bad for us. Not only in terms of what we eat, but especially in terms of how that food is produced, harvested, processed, and shipped. Dr. Wallinga's work on why so many industrial toxins have come to pollute the food chain and how those pollutants often impact greatest on the most vulnerable Americans. And in his current job with the Natural Resource Defense Council, Wallinga works on the enormous overuse of human antibiotics on factory farms and feedlots in the U.S., and how that threatens not only the health of the nation, but the future of modern medicine. He is also was the co-founder of Healthy Food Action, and we'll talk about that as well. So please, Dr. Willinger, welcome, and please join us.
Thanks, it's my pleasure.
Thank you so much for joining us. Your work is just so important and fascinating, and I'm really so thrilled to have you on. And I thought maybe before we get into all the questions, you could share a little bit about your history. As a physician, did you always work in policy issues in regards to food, nutrition, and public health? Or did you come to that from seeing the results of your patients getting sick?
Well, I didn't always work in that, but it happened pretty early in my career. I've always been somebody that liked to span different interests, and I've always been somebody interested in the environment. And as I went through my medical training, it became pretty clear to me that unlike 100 years ago, when people got sick and died mostly of infections, the story in modern medicine over the last several decades has really been about the rise in chronic diseases. And so much of the epidemics of chronic disease that we have now, whether it's Alzheimer's disease or diabetes or, you name it, cancer, they're connected to the environment. So really the conditions that set us up for those kinds of things have nothing to do with what's going on in the doctor's office and everything to do with the broader environment that we live in and raise our families in.
Mm-hmm. So right now, I know in your work with the Natural Resource Defense Council, you're really looking at the overuse of antibiotics and the problem that antibiotic-resistant bacteria has. It's been in the news so much lately, as I shared when I was talking earlier about, you know, the article in the New York Times about simple urinary tract infection, which used to be a no-brainer. You would just go and, you know, if the cranberry juice didn't work, you'd go and get an antibiotic, and voila, it was gone. And now it's becoming a real issue. People are not getting better by these antibiotics. Can you talk a little bit about why antibiotics aren't such a reliable treatment anymore and how bacteria mutates to become antibiotic resistant?
Yeah. In the simplest explanation, it's really about evolution. Bacteria evolve much more quickly than people do. They have fast lives, and there's a lot of them. And from one resistant bacteria to a billion can take place in a matter of 24 hours. It's that fast. So you can actually see evolution happening in bacterial populations in real time.
Wow.
So what's that have to do with how we're using antibiotics? It kind of has everything to do with numbers. The more antibiotics we use and the more we overuse them, the more we're setting up conditions for evolution to happen. So if you expose bacteria, whether in your household or in your gut or, on a farm, the more you use antibiotics, the more you're exposing those bacteria and selecting for drug-resistant bacteria. So the solution to the problem is really quite simple. We've got to stop overusing antibiotics and really just use them wherever, only when absolutely necessary.
Mm-hmm. And I think people are starting to hear that and, not take an antibiotic when they have a virus. But there's so many hidden antibiotics that people have no idea about. Can we talk a little bit about the overuse of antibiotics in the foods that people are eating and in livestock?
Yeah, sure. I want to clear up one thing. We're not talking about a problem that stems from residues of antibiotics, by and large. We're talking about when you use enormous amounts of antibiotics on farms, it creates these bacteria that then are drug resistant that travel from the farm environment downwind and downstream and reach the human population. So that's what we're talking about. So what we're mostly worried about is drug resistance to the antibiotics that doctors and other health professionals most rely on. So you can call them human antibiotics. You can call them medically important antibiotics. But basically, they're antibiotics that we all recognize as important to us. So penicillins, tetracyclines, sulfa drugs, erythromycin, names like that. And the tragic thing is that about two-thirds of all those human antibiotics that are sold are actually being sold for use in livestock or poultry, which is crazy, right? Because we know that that's basically setting up an antibiotic resistance factory on these farms. And at least, you know, the world's experts, infectious disease doctors and public health experts, now pretty much agree that this overuse on farms is a big driver in a global epidemic of drug-resistant bacteria causing, you know, huge numbers of infections and deaths throughout the world. And it's getting worse.
Mm-hmm. And you talk about human antibiotics as opposed to other antibiotics. What other antibiotics are there? And because I have actually, I believe I had read that in some, you know, when factories want to greenwash, they say no human antibiotics used, but they use other kind of antibiotics. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, there's different classes of antibiotics, and the mechanisms that cause resistance are more concerning in the strains of bacteria that are important to people. So, you know, kind of to go back to basics, if I am eating meat that's contaminated, as most of our meat supplies is contaminated with antibiotic-resistant bacteria now, when we eat that, potentially those resistant bacteria end up in our gut, and the bacteria can actually swap resistance with other bacteria in our gut. And maybe that won't cause a problem for me now because I'm a healthy young person. You know, I'm a college student, for example, or I'm just kind of in the prime of my life. But we continue to harbor those drug-resistant bacteria in our body. And when they do cause a problem is when our immune system's depressed, when we're in the hospital for some other reason. Maybe we're on chemotherapy. Maybe we're about to get an organ transplant. And that's when those resistant bugs that we've been carrying around for a long time come back to bite us and can cause real problems and even death. So that's kind of the you know, the setup of events that happen. There are different classes of bacteria. Some are not considered important to people, and they have names like ionophores, and those have been used on farms as well, and we're not as worried about that. What we are worried about, though, are these human antibiotic classes or medically important antibiotics. And in fact, there may be the majority of antibiotics used on farms, and we're using many, many more of them on farms than we actually use in human medicine, believe it or not.
Mm-hmm. But those ones you're not as concerned about? They don't also affect the antibiotic resistance?
They may cause resistance in bacteria to those antibiotics, but because those aren't the antibiotics used in human medicine, it's a kind of resistance that's not as concerning for human health.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know that this has been in the news and we've been, you know, factory farms know about it, but in this country, that information, trying to get that information is really quite hidden and they are not forthcoming with that information. I know recently you did a news brief called Better Bacon, where you compared the amount of antibiotics used in the U.S., and compared it to other countries. Can you talk about that and why
Sure.
our country is so hard to make that transition?
Sure. So basically, the practices on a lot of these industrial or factory farms are not in public view, and some of the worst actors would like to keep it that way, I think, in part because the use of antibiotics is so prevalent and really very unnecessary when we compare how many U.S. farms operate to how farms are operating in other places, including Europe. So there's a variety of different ways that kind of a cloak has been pulled over the operations on these huge farms and feedlots. One way is that the industry has convinced the USDA and the Food and Drug Administration really not to collect data on antibiotic use on farms. All we have is sales data. And that's not a bad thing. I mean, sales data is a pretty good proxy. If we know how many antibiotic products are sold that are intended for use in farms, it's a pretty good indication of what's actually being used in farms. But ideally, we'd like to really have reporting from farms or from veterinarians or both about what drugs they're actually using. And right. There's been many decades over which, recommendations have been made to federal agencies to create a system for tracking that antibiotic use, but they really don't want to. And you know, the large farms and the large meat producers don't want them to either. And so it's left up to people like me to try to pull the wool back from people's eyes and really try to find data from here and there and put it together in a way that really better describes what's happening on farms. And so that's what Better Bacon does. And actually, I'm working on a, for lack of a better name, a Better Beef version of that report that looks at the beef industry. Now, one thing we learned from Better Bacon, And by the way, you can find that on NRDC's website, which is just nrdc.org. But one of the things we learned is that the pork industry has maintained for eons that they actually need to use huge amounts of antibiotics to keep pigs healthy. And what Better Bacon concluded was, in fact, that's not true at all. There are countries in Europe that are major pork producers that use as little as 1/7 the amount of antibiotics per pound of pork that the U.S. industry uses. And even maybe more importantly, even while the U.S. is using huge amounts of antibiotics, the pigs on these factory pig farms are actually getting sicker. So really their own rationale doesn't hold water when you look at the data, and the data, that data is collected by USDA. They just don't report it in a way that makes it easy to tell the story. So that's what we set out to do.
Mm-hmm. And in that report, they talked about Denmark and the Netherlands, that they used to use as much antibiotics as before as the US does, but that they transitioned and reduced the amount that they used. And that's, you know, that we could learn from that and use them as an example, and yet they're not willing to.
Absolutely. I mean, this is not rocket science, right? Few things are. It boils down to leadership and will and desire. And both in Denmark and the Netherlands, Denmark first and then the Netherlands quite a bit later, the public basically demanded that the farm sector change its practices, and the political leadership heard that and made a decision to change course. And they said, look, the first thing we're going to do is to actually set some targets for reducing use and figure out how to do that. And they've been fantastically successful. So if you compare, for example, antibiotic use in Danish livestock to the peak, they've been able to reduce their overall antibiotic use by 55 or 60%. And in the Netherlands, they've reduced it even more and more quickly. So within just 3 or 4 years in the Netherlands, they reduced antibiotic use by about 60%. So not only is it doable, but it's something that can be done relatively quickly with the adoption of leadership and political will. So that's
right. And that's what I was saying at the beginning to my listeners, is it takes all of us to rise up and to, you know, to yell out and to shout out and to write our elected officials and to make our voices heard, because we do have power if we exercise it. But people don't exercise it, or there's just so many issues to exercise it over. It's tiring.
Right. Yeah. And you know, two of the most powerful industries in Washington are the meat industry and the pharmaceutical industry. So, you know, there's a lot of, unfortunately, a lot of elected officials who maybe don't want to take that battle on. But, you know, it just underscores your point that eventually numbers talk. And if enough constituents bring forth their stories of relatives that have gotten really sick or died of resistant infections, and that you know, the evidence is there that this is connected to how we're misusing and overusing these same drugs on livestock farms, you know, then we would see some action. But it's just not happened yet.
Absolutely. Well, on that note, let's just take a couple minute break. And when we come back, maybe we can talk a little bit more about what the public can do and how we can push against the meat lobbyists. So everyone, don't go anywhere. I'm talking with Dr. David Walinga, and you're listening to Bhavani at I Eat Green. Be right back.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, the founder of the Progressive Radio Network. Today, we have more than 80 producers bringing forth the most progressive and most liberating information, the kind of information you do not regularly hear on any of the mainstream or alternative media. You can help us now. Up to this point, I have virtually supported the Progressive Radio Network, all of its expenses and payroll, myself. But we would like to expand our reach. We'd like to do far more. We'd like to be able to advertise on Facebook and let others know we exist. We are the number one progressive radio network in the world. In fact, we have programs that are most listened to in all of progressive radio. But we could go a lot further. Our message can reach a lot more people, especially at a time when people are desperate for honest, objective insights on the important topical issues of our day. How can you help? It's simple. Go to prn.fm, go to our main page. In the upper right-hand corner, you'll see a little button, Support Now. And then whatever you can contribute on a monthly basis will make a big difference. It will help get the message out. It will help inform more people, give them more choices. This is where you'll hear in the independent candidates and the people looking to challenge the corruption in government and the industries. But we need to get our reach out further. So please, whatever you can afford on a monthly basis, and there's some suggestions there, and it'll be automatic. All right, thank you very much for continuing to help us help you and the rest of the world on these important issues.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at I Eat Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And if you're just joining us, I'm talking with Dr. David Walinga about antibiotic resistance in our food system. So, David, can you talk a little bit about what kind of regulations could be put in place that might help reduce the use of antibiotics in animal production?
Sure. So, you know, I want to talk about policies, both private policies and public policies. So you're talking about public policy, which can happen at a lot of different levels. And there's things we could talk about at the national level, but also at the state and more local level. So we should do that. But my best set of ideas was actually 2 years ago, or a little more than 2 years ago, there were a group of experts, physicians, infectious disease physicians, veterinarians, including many from Europe, that were brought together by George Washington University, and they deliberated. There were 12 of them. They deliberated, and they put out a roadmap of policy recommendations. So if you go to battlesuperbugs.com and search for policy roadmap, you'll see those, and there's 11 recommendations. I won't try to describe them all, but they're really very commonsensical, and many of them are the same kinds of things we already know will work because they've been done in Europe. So they're easy to do. There's evidence that they'll work, and, you know, we just need policymakers basically to pull the trigger. So the one I like most to talk about is two things. One, as I said before, we have to start tracking antibiotics where they're being used on farms. Pretty simple, right? You don't know if something's a problem or how much of a problem it is unless you're looking at it, and we're not looking at it. Two, we need to set targets for reducing the antibiotic use on farms, much of which is completely unnecessary. So, for example, the Obama administration put out something called the National Action Plan on Combating Antibiotic-Resistant Bacteria. And so they devised a 5-year national plan, and among the things that they said was, we want to reduce the use of antibiotics in human medicine by X percent, you know, both in hospitals and, more importantly, kind of unnecessary use in the clinic. So a lot of us have had the experience, or we should have had the experience of, you know, getting a virus, a cold, and going to the doctor and, you know, wondering if we should get an antibiotic. And the doctor says, no, well, in fact, antibiotics don't work on viruses. They only work on bacteria, all of which is true. So that's an easy thing. Just stop giving people antibiotics for viral infections where they don't work. But we don't have that kind of target in the National Action Plan for agriculture. And, you know, in my work with NRDC, I repeatedly have voiced, urged a recommendation on FDA that they set such a target, but FDA doesn't want to set a target to reduce antibiotics on U.S. Livestock farms. So those are two simple examples, but there's many more in that policy roadmap.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's infuriating the power that lobbyists have in our government, you know, just all across the board, whether it's the meat lobbyists, the pharmaceutical lobbyists. You know, I'm working in school food quite a bit, and the power of who would think that there's a frozen pizza lobbyist and a frozen French fry right. lobbyist, but there is, you know, and those people, right. when they were trying to reduce pizza and French fries in the school lunch program, they went berserk. And the pressure from them, you know, got, you know, the Obama administration to even reverse it back then. I mean, and of course, the Trump administration is, you know, rolling back those regulations even more. I mean, something has to be done about the power that these lobbyists have. And the only power that we have against them, I think, is the quantity of people that could rise up, but don't.
The tragedy here is that, you know, once we lose our stockpile of antibiotics that actually work, we're going to be in a pretty big hole. We don't have and haven't had a pipeline to develop new antibiotics for decades, so we've basically been living on borrowed time. And when we overuse the antibiotics we have now to the extent that they no longer work, that's when people are going to start dying in greater and greater numbers because there's simply no alternative. And that's unlikely to, in my opinion, that's unlikely to change. So we don't have any alternative other than to do a better job at stewarding the antibiotics we have right now. And that begins with dramatically reducing the use. And as I said, 2/3 of the sales of these important human antibiotics are for use on livestock farms.
Mm-hmm.
So what we can do, and what has worked in the U.S., since we don't have the political leadership, is to push on companies. So let's look at what's happened in chicken. When I first started this work 20 years ago, chicken producers were using huge amounts of antibiotics and feeding those to flocks of birds, and feeding them things like arsenic as well, by the way, to make the birds grow faster. Well, now the industry leaders have completely switched course. You know, there's no more arsenic fed to birds. And they, within a few short years, basically realized that they didn't need to use antibiotics much at all, if at all. And so now, by our estimation, about half of the chicken sold in the U.S. now is raised without any human antibiotics at all, which is a fantastic success story. And it happened because of us, because of consumers basically voicing to the Tysons and the Purdues and the Sanderson Farms that they didn't want to buy chicken raised with human antibiotics anymore. And so, you know, every year we're part of a coalition called the Antibiotics Off the Menu Coalition, and we put out a report card on the nation's leading fast and casual food chains, so, you know, the McDonald's and the Burger Kings and the Taco Bells and the Chipotles, and we grade them on their antibiotic policies. And this year is going to be the fifth year of that report. And like I said, the change in the policies on chicken production are just astounding in a good way.
Why do you think it happened on the chicken, in the chicken arena, and not in the beef or pork arena?
And that was my next point, is that, you know, we've seen virtually no change in pork and beef. The reason is that chicken only lives 6 weeks. You mean from hatching to slaughter, the modern American chicken lives 6 weeks, 42 days. And so that's not much time for illness to develop. So even if conditions are pretty bad, the birds just, you're able to get them through that 6 weeks without antibiotics pretty easily, and still maintain them in kind of pretty industrial conditions. So if you have industrial conditions with a lot of crowding of animals and a lot of stress, in a longer living animal, so a cow lives about a year and a half on average, a lot of it on a feedlot. A pig lives about 6 months, much longer than the 6 weeks that a bird lives. And so those conditions are much more likely to cause problems in those animals. So you have two choices. You can change the conditions, which is what they've done in Europe. They've actually created better farm conditions, more humane and healthier for animals, and as a result, they don't use antibiotics anymore because they don't have sick animals. In the U.S., we still have sick animals, and they seem to be getting sicker, and we're still using more and more antibiotics compared to these European countries.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, if we try to encourage everybody to buy organic, you know, where they're not using antibiotics, we know that that's unaffordable for so many people, right?
It's true. Organic is one style of production that doesn't allow antibiotics, so that is one way. But, you know, there's a lot of labels out there that don't allow antibiotic use. For example, there's a label that's used for chicken called Certified Responsible Antibiotic Use. It's not so much in the supermarket, but commercial buyers of chicken can source using that label. And basically, there's no price difference between a conventional factory-raised chicken and it's called the CRAW standard, Certified Responsible Antibiotic Use. So a CRAW chicken costs about the same as a conventionally raised chicken. It just doesn't use antibiotics. So we really can't say that the cost is a reason for not serving chicken in schools, for example, raised without routine antibiotics, because it doesn't cost any different.
Right, right. Well, I'm new in the school. I just recently took on a farm-to-school coordinator for a local school district that was awarded a grant from New York State. And as of yet, I have not seen any real chicken. All they have is chicken nuggets. So that's part of my work. You know, so many schools don't even see anything that looks like a chicken, let alone one with or without antibiotics.
So you're in New York. Let me give your listeners a great New York example of where a physician, Ken Jaffe, he's a physician who also has been a dairy farmer in New York, and he and some people he's worked with have set up a program that is going to source dairy cattle to be ground up into beef and served in schools around Ithaca. And they're working with veterinarians at Cornell to make sure that those dairy cattle have many fewer antibiotics given to them. And so there are ways to work to get kids and others eating meat raised with many fewer antibiotics. But in this case, you know, Ken and the people he works with really were providing the spark, the leadership to make that happen. And it's going to be good for New York farmers, New York dairy farmers, because they're going to get a price premium. And it's going to be good for kids. And it's good for the rest of us because they're using fewer antibiotics.
Right. Yeah, that would be good. I know our school does source hamburgers from a source that does not use any antibiotics in the meat. But because of it, and it is a price, you know, it is more expensive, they only serve it, you know, once or twice a month because it's more expensive. So, but I guess I think the parents really got alarmed when they saw all the pink slime in the news years ago and rallied for healthier meat, but not for the other stuff. So we have work cut out for us. So what do you suggest, or what can consumers do to protect themselves? I mean, I guess we just talked about buying, you know, looking for labels that have no antibiotics, and it's easier to find it in chicken. But with beef and pork, if people want to reduce their exposure, is there any label other than organic?
There is, actually. I mean, there's now raised with antibiotics is a label that's being used. Grass-fed is a USDA-certified label, and the animals raised on grass, the cattle, are not getting antibiotics, by and large. It's part of the label. So, and then, of course, you mentioned certified organic. There are other labels, too. I mean, one of the folks at Consumer Reports have maintained a website for quite a while that goes through different consumer labels and kind of tells the skinny on which labels are good, what exactly they mean. I think it's called green labels, but I could be wrong about that. But check that out in terms of good consumer labels, including those with respect to antibiotics. The other thing is, your farmer's market has a lot of farmers that are able to tell you whether or not they're using antibiotics. And my experience at my farmer's market is that, you know, you can pretty much believe what they say. If you buy direct, you're putting more money in their pocket, and the price isn't necessarily more than you'd pay at the grocery store, or even less, because you're cutting out the middlemen and buying direct from the producers. So you actually know quite a bit more. And if your family eats a lot of meat, it's an affordable way to get chicken or beef or pork, and be somewhat assured that there's not antibiotics used, or at least used very very occasionally.
Right. And the other thing is to reduce people's consumption of meat. That is also a positive, I think, for reducing how much exposure they have to antibiotics. One of your articles on NRDC talks a little bit about that Impossible Burger, which is not so good, because you have to be aware that, you know, a lot of these meat alternatives are loaded with genetically modified organisms and pesticides and herbicides, and so they're not all what they're cracked at to be either, right?
There's a lot of questions about the cell cultures, like that go into some of the new non-meat meats. So one thing is that if you've got, there's basically, it's like a giant petri dish, basically, where they culture cells and then grow them in a laboratory environment, right? And turn those into a hamburger. But antibiotics probably are being used in a lot of those cell culture lines to control contamination. But we don't know that because it's pretty unregulated as right now. And there's no public disclosure about that antibiotic use. So I'm going to be watching that development to see if the companies or the entities that are launching those new products are actually coming clean about their antibiotic use. I think ideally they would commit to not using antibiotics.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, we're just about out of time, so I want to thank you so much, David, for joining us. And the work you're doing is just priceless. Thank you so much. Everyone out there, thank you for joining us. I've been talking with Dr. David Walinga from the Natural Resource Defense Council and Healthy Food Action. And I'll see you all again next week. Bye for now.